an interview with Professors Robert Dodd and Tobias Owen of the Department of Earth and Space Sciences, November 10, 1988.
Well, that ought to get us. Okay. Let's start with you, Bob, because you came a little bit before Toby did.
Yes.
And let's follow the questions down to down to number 7.
Here's the sheet.
I thought you had.
No, I don't think so.
You don't. All right.
Okay. Name, Robert Dodd, Department ESS.
You got it, so let's get that.
Name, Robert Dodd, Department ESS, rank or position, professor. Came to Stony Brook in 1965 at age 29. I came from the Air Force Cambridge Research Laboratories at Hanscom Field, Bedford, Massachusetts. And Oliver Schaefer was responsible for my coming to Stony Brook. He interviewed me. I was also interviewed by David Fox, who was then the graduate director, and by Colonel Hartson. I came because I am a New Yorker and because I was very excited by the prospect of what appeared to be a very ambitious new educational institution. And I don't understand. What was the vision being transformed into reality?
Well, what was the purpose of the institution as you understood it?
Transforming mud into buildings.
Transforming mud into buildings, bricks without straw, with increasingly without straw. The vision was that it was going to be the flagship of the state system. It was going to be the most influential science center in the system, and a comprehensive graduate and research institution. I know that's the vision that Oliver had, and that most of us had at that time. Now, that was my understanding of what Stony Brook wanted to be. The expression used was Berkeley of the East, which was a little intoxicated.
Right, somewhat. And probably used by John Tull.
No, before John.
Before John.
Because it was in Time magazine, and I found out about Stony Brook from my mother, who tipped me off that something big was going on. And it just happened that I met Oliver in the fall of 64 at a meeting, and the two events coincided. So.
And in 64, was he already at Stony Brook?
He was already teaching, but the department didn't exist.
I see.
He was teaching, I think, probably at the behest of Francis Bonner. He and Francis were very close.
Yes. All right. At that point, why don't you say what you know about Ollie Schaefer? See, I knew him back at Brookhaven and had dealings with him one way or another. I was in the director's office, and he had a laboratory. But I did not know his background professionally. Where did he get his PhD, his training?
I'd want to verify, but I'm pretty sure it was Columbia.
Columbia, I see.
And I think he was at Penn State before that.
I see.
He is a Pennsylvania fellow. I was going to say Pennsylvania boy, but that's...
And he came here directly from the Brookhaven.
From Brookhaven.
All right. Anything further you know about him, that you know about him? You know, what about his reputation?
His reputation was very good. He was, by training, a nuclear chemist, and he had used this in the early stages of solar system research. In particular the use of noble gases to both to determine the ages of extraterrestrial materials and also to determine the radiation history. And he was very well regarded on this side of the water, and I would say even better regarded in Europe.
Yeah, right.
A very strong following in Europe, particularly in Germany.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's stop here and do the same thing for you now.
All right.
Okay, let's get into questions. You better agree.
Okay, so I'm Toby Owen. I'm a professor in the Earth and Space Sciences. Earth and Space Sciences Department. I came to Stony Brook in 1970 at the age of 34. I was a visiting associate professor at Caltech immediately before that, but my home base at the time would have been the IIT Research Institute in Chicago. I came to Stony Brook. My initial awareness of Stony Brook came from a guy named Ishtiak Rasool, who was at that time at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. And he had been in contact with Schaefer and also with Steve Strom. And he was quite enthusiastic about Stony Brook. He had run a summer school out here, and in fact, he invited me to come to one of them.
How do you spell his first name?
I-C-H-T-I-A-Q-U-E. Rasool is R-A-S-O-O-L. And I was pleased with what I saw. I think I was quite excited about the idea of having astronomy together with the earth sciences. That was a unique combination, as far as I was aware of, and the sense of growth, of openness, that we were going to be free to pretty much direct the research and curriculum was very appealing.
There was the building
big sense
then?
No.
Because, I guess it was when you got
yes, the building was done when I got
there.
Right. But at the time I arrived, the building didn't belong yet to the Earth and Space Sciences Department. It was occupied by several other groups, including the Gilbert's operation, whatever that was at the time. The
undergraduate studies, I guess.
Okay.
Well, that's the history of the university. The building for multi-purpose had to be for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So Schaefer interviewed me, and I also spoke to the people who were already here at the time. But I guess the only official interview would have been Schaefer. I never saw anybody else in the administration. And I learned later that that was not uncommon. Okay, and I've told you why I came. I guess I didn't have that much of a vision about Stony Brook in the SUNY system. It was more the sense that here was a vigorous, growing university, and that was appealing, how open everything was, and there were a lot of entrenched positions.
Do you want to say what your particular field was, and then I'd like to get yours too, Bob?
Okay, I was trained in astronomy, but my specialty was planetary studies, and that's pretty much stayed the case. At the time I arrived, I had just become involved in space missions. Up to that time, I had only been working with ground-based observations.
Ground-based
observations using telescopes. But I had just joined the Viking project to land on Mars, and I was beginning work on the what became the Voyager project to the outer solar system.
All right. What was your
your field?
I was trained in geology, and as a consequence of the commitment to the Air Force, became diverted first to lunar research and then into meteorites. And I'm quite confident the reason why Oliver brought me here was because I was interested in meteorites. We overlapped in that respect, I see. And that's been my principal concentration ever since.
When did you first get the moon rocks back? When was that?
That would have been 1969.
69.
Late summer of 69,
I see.
And I believe we didn't get them here until quite a bit thereafter. A lot of the work was done in Houston.
I see.
The preliminary work.
Was Ollie involved in that? Schaefer involved?
He was, very much. In fact, he produced the first radiometric age for a lunar rock. Did it somewhat sub rosa, and lost one or two friends as a consequence. Nobody important, just Jerry Wasserberg. I wish you were here to tell it, Carl. It's a marvelous little story.
Well, why don't you tell what you know?
Well, Oliver arranged himself in the lunar receiving laboratory so that he'd be next to S.R. Taylor of Canberra. Because Ross was Canberra,
Australia.
Ross was detailed to measure total potassium. Oliver was measuring argon-40, and he realized that all he needed to get an age was potassium plus argon-40 plus some reasonable assumptions about the isotopic distribution in the lunar material, and he came up with an age. It was not his job to come up with the age. And how it got to the New York Times, I'm not certain. But the upshot is that he scooped Jerry Wasserberg, and Wasserberg was extremely upset about it. And of course, at Stony Brook, the flags waved. So it was very exciting. He didn't do anything wrong, as Oliver said. He said it wasn't. He said he just looked over, and there's Ross doing the potassium, and it was just an obvious thing to do.
What about the evolution of the department? What can you say about that?
Well,
how many people were here when you came, Bob?
There were three of us in the first year. Oliver Schaefer, Sam Goldick, who was a geochemist of considerable age and even greater reputation. And I was the third one.
G-O-L-D-I-E?
G-O-L-D-I-C-H. Samuel Stephen Goldick. The objective was to develop a department of 60 faculty in four disciplines, which would have been astronomy, geology, meteorology, oceanography. At full complement, it would have been 60 faculty, and we anticipated 200 graduate students. That was the target. And quite early on, we populated astronomy, and I think we did that, as a matter of fact, I don't think we started astronomy until the third year. The second year, we started with oceanography, but it aborted. We had two oceanographers who moved across to marine sciences. We lost the initiative there. But since very early, we've had strength in astronomy and in geology, and through Toby, an effort in atmospheric sciences. That's a capsule. I think we were at full development, or at least at our present size, by about 1970. We grew like weeds.
You had good support, did you, from the administration?
Yes, I'd say in the first 5 years we had excellent support.
Did you have a hand in planning the building?
Yes. The way that typically worked was that Oliver and Sam disagreed on almost everything. And I would try to be the swing vote, and Sam would tell me to go to hell, or shut up, or something else that's inappropriate. I had a small impact on the building. I was there.
Well, I think I remember that the building received some sort of an award, architectural award. Can you be specific about that?
My understanding, Carl, is that it was for the most building for the fewest dollars. I don't think it was put quite that bluntly, but I think that was the thrust of it, which was that it was a bargain. I'm not persuaded at this distance from the event that it was, but I think that was the nature of the award. Toby, do you remember anything about that?
No. Before my time.
Not much. We spent a lot of time on laying out the building. It was Oliver in particular.
Did you have any contact with the central office, with a state university architect? I think it was Steve.
I'm sure we did, but I don't recall being involved in it. I think that was probably just Oliver. Most of the design was Oliver's. Because he and Sam tended to be opposed on almost everything, Oliver made most of the decisions.
I see. You want to pick it up from there with regard to your own work?
Well, I'd like to pick it up from there with respect to, I guess, questions down the list there of how things have changed since arriving. And I wanted to follow up a couple things that Bob said. That I think it's true that support was very good the first 5 years, but then we ran into a change in attitude in the state, I guess,
yes.
And also a different set of priorities in the country. And funding became very tight. And, you know, we're sitting now in Bob Dodd's laboratory, in a building which I guess at this point is 20 years old, right? And when we got here, it was brand new. And it's always exciting to work with new things, especially things that have been carefully designed or at least had some thought put into them to serve the function that they actually serve. But 20 years is a long time for a building. And I think the disappointment I have felt, and others as well, is that we, for whatever reasons, have not had sufficient support from the state to maintain the level of excitement and vigor that existed at the time we came. And we see the manifestations of that in the paint peeling off the wall,
sure.
Watermarks, and the deterioration of the physical plant. That is a very depressing thing to live with. And it not only lowers the mood of the faculty, but it is a message that the students get as well. I mean, in this building right now, we have what should be, and was at the time, a very nice auditorium. We can't use it, and we haven't been able to for over a year. The stuff is falling off the ceiling, water comes pouring through, and it rains. I mean, it's appalling. And we had to close it. We had to stop having public lectures there until finally the campus closed the thing down completely. We were still giving lectures to students in what amounted to a slump. And this is a very sad situation.
The roof has leaked for upwards of 10 years, and nothing was done about it
for
almost that length of time. And when it was finally dealt with, it was discovered that there was asbestos in the ceiling, whereupon it got to be two jobs instead of one. The asbestos is being cleared now, but Gil Hansen tells me the lecture hall will not be back in service before the fall of 1990. It will have been in a bad state for 13 years.
But at least that particular thing, you see, is getting concentrated attention, but the rest of the building is deteriorating. I mean, this building in places looks as bad to me as buildings that I was used to at the University of Chicago that were 50 years old or more.
It's true.
What is Gil Hansen's position now?
He's chair of the department.
because there was a Hansen who was the engineer on some of the campus projects.
I know two other Hansons on the campus, but neither would fit those specifications.
To whom do you complain? To whom do you go?
Well, as a department, we're very unified on these kinds of issues. And we have gone to everybody we could think of, all the way to the president.
I see.
And we talked to the buildings and grounds people. We talked to vice presidents in charge of this stuff. And we've written endless memos.
It is very depressing, Carl, and I didn't know when thinking about this interview how far you wanted to go into changes in our perception of the place.
Well, it's one of the questions. That's why I picked it up.
Those of us who were here in the beginning, I think, are probably more torn up over what's going on now than even Toby. Because Rockefeller had a dream. And a large component of that dream was this campus.
That's right.
And I remember when he came and dedicated the place. It was the beginning of student unrest. And he was magnificent. He was strong for Stony Brook and for the state system.
Now, this dedication of this building was 68.
The cornerstone says 68 out there.
Yeah, but I think the dedication was 69. I think we moved in the fall of 69.
I see. Okay.
And before that, we lived in old physics.
Right.
All over old physics. One in the attic, one in the third floor, one in the second, first, down in the basement.
Well, Rockefeller was a five-legged capital from Doc. You didn't have to talk to him in words of one syllable about a university.
That's true.
Since then, everything's been downhill.
Steadily,
yes.
Steadily.
In the sense of the central office.
My enthusiasm for Cuomo for president is only partly because I think he'd be a good president. I'd also like to try somebody else in Albany because I don't think he's very good for public education.
No. Well, he's a graduate of St. John's.
Sure. But then again, Rockefeller's graduate of Dartmouth. So there's more to it than just the private-public split. No, I think Rockefeller, my God, he nearly bankrupted the state in the process, but what he left behind is so good. Never mind. You pay towards something. But the present situation is most distressing. I have to go to an admissions committee meeting at 3 o'clock, and the prospect depresses me utterly because...
Well, I wanted to get to that. Tara, I wanted to get to the quality of students.
You want to do that now?
Might as well. How far back can you go on the quality of students?
Well, I can go to the beginning.
All right.
And at the risk of this falling into the wrong hands, I'll even make some very strong ethnic comments because they're cogent.
All right.
When we came here in 65, there were not enough students in the department to launch normal courses, so our real courses began in 66, and they were small classes. But the students were, in general, very bright. They were very largely Jewish students. And they were principally kids who didn't go to Harvard, principally for lack of money. But they were intellectually very, very strong. And they were exciting people. And for the first few years of the department, when we had very few graduate students, we used undergraduate students, many of whom were fully competitive with what later became as graduate students. My own feeling is that the thing that really tip things away from us was the decision to allow tuition assistance money to be used in private schools within the state. And I recall John Toll and Alec Pond being terribly upset about that. And at the time they felt that this step was going to tilt the table back toward the privates and away from places like Stony Brook.
I think it did.
And in recent years, we've had a great difficulty meeting the state's requirements as to enrollment, and the cost of meeting them or even approaching them has been to lower the standard. And the result is a fairly weak student group. That's my picture of them. You see them every day, too.
Yes, I think I would agree that the quality of the students has gone down. And the way I would say it, I guess, is that when I first came here, for the first few years, there were always some really bright students that you'd encounter in a large class or a small class. Not a whole lot, but always some. And they would go on to the best schools in the country, the best graduate schools, Caltech, Cornell, MIT. And then they began to get fewer and fewer.
Yes.
And we just don't seem to have, though, that top echelon. Or at least it isn't as visible in our department. Now, I don't know how much that's a question of those students simply not being on campus, or whether they're on campus, but they're taking courses in other departments. Or they're in our department, but they're less visible. All I can tell you is that my observation is that I don't see them.
Yes.
These days.
Well, I think Ren Minisco would be able to tell you that. He's the person who has been in charge of university studies. He's a very bright guy, and been on top of what has happened statistically in the student body. Now, I guess, for 15, 20 years. Got a good perspective.
Who's done this?
Raymond Wistro. M-A-N-I-U-S-K-O-W, I think.
Well, it's a W, but the rest is right.
Yeah.
Those are the real data. I mean, obviously, our impressions are bound to be subjective.
Yes.
But that's all we have to work with.
Well, as an example, Carl, and Don Winsley could give you the same story. Both of us taught the freshman geology class early in the history of the department and are now teaching it again. In my case, the gap is something like 18 years. I go back to my notes from the earlier period, and I'm astonished at how much more I gave them then than I can give them now. And Don has had the same experience. He's pulled out old examinations which simply would destroy the present classes. There's no doubt there has been a real change.
How many graduate students do you have?
I think it's between 50 and 55.
But that's another change that has occurred.
It peaked at about 70 several years ago.
That was triggered in part by the oil crisis or something.
Yeah, the oil crisis, and also for a long while we were fueled by the enthusiasm for space research.
That's right, that too. And there's been a general decline across the country in physical sciences.
10% in geology.
There were statistics in something I saw recently, maybe Physics Today, that over 50% of the graduate students in physical sciences these days are foreign-born. And that's a change that just happened in the last few years, I guess.
How do you account for it?
Well, I think there are a variety of factors. One of them seems to be that this mysterious subject called business, which when I was in school was regarded as beneath contempt, is suddenly a very popular and exciting field. And so a lot of very bright people are going into that and becoming investment bankers or whatever with an MBA, earning vast amounts of money and living happily ever after, I guess.
Well, the job opportunities are also rather limited in the basic sciences.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the comparison, it's pretty devastating what you can do with an MBA and what you can do with a PhD in astronomy. Forget it.
The national fascination with science has lost its bloom.
Yes, that too.
And for that, I hold the administration in Washington very largely responsible. I think our leadership has been pathetic. I anticipate that we're about to have four more years of it. of course, we're paying awfully high bills and getting nothing back except receipts for interest. So the country's not awash with money to spend on projects. But, basically, once the Apollo mission flew, things began to skid in the space program. And after 1973, by 1973, people hardly paid attention to lunar walk. And thereafter, it's been rather steadily down.
You say once the Apollo missions were through?
Once it flew. Once the first one flew. We saw the same thing with the space shuttle. The first one was a source of great excitement in uncorking champagne bottles, and then the public interest diminishes very swiftly.
But the money that's available for basic research probably isn't too different, right? Except it's different in different areas. You're talking about the enthusiasm of the public, their awareness and their orientation.
There isn't public pressure.
That is true. But again, I think that it's part of a general pattern that you have to look at what's happened to our electronics industry, for example, where we used to be the best in the world, or the automobile industry, or various areas of innovative technology. We're just not there anymore. And somehow it's connected, right? I don't think it's a coincidence.
Well, we were terribly damaged by the 1979 embargo in particular. We were not at all ready for that. The oil embargo. That's Reagan loves to blame all this on Carter, but basically it was the OPEC, the strength of OPEC at that time, that decimated our economy and it's had shockwaves that have traveled all the way up to the present.
But the sense that doing innovative technology is an exciting career, or doing basic research, doing science, is really fun and exciting. I think that's just not there at the same level that it used to be.
I have a local theory for Long Island. It doesn't explain the general statement. I think you're right that it's nationwide. But I think on Long Island we have a particular problem, which is that about 10 years ago, the standard outlet for the fourth quartile of Stony Brook students was high school teacher. We produced a tremendous number of teachers, most of whom did not stray far from alma mater. And when we get kids who've had really miserable introductions to science in high school, I always have a dark suspicion that it's our product that taught those kids. In fact, in some cases, I know it to be the case.
Not encouraging.
This is the chickens are coming home to foul. No, it is discouraging. And the mood on this campus, I think, is frightening. And if the students aren't frightened, I think it probably says something terrible about their lack of sensitivity. Because it was a sharp-edged place. Well, you remember when you were running the thing. It was not comfortable, not pleasant. It was muddy and miserable. But there was an aggressive enthusiasm. There was a feeling that we're wading through thick and thin, but we're really building something. And you could get ulcers from it, but you wouldn't die of boredom. Now there's a constant feeling that, you want your lab cleaned? Stand on the queue. It probably won't be done until next month, because we're shorthanded. I had to run all over the campus looking for a key to get a projection screen to work in old chemistry, because it doesn't have a building manager. It's under the wing of another guy who's over in the new chemistry wing. All over the place, you're inconvenienced by a lack of the doers on the campus. Save the faculty, get rid of the secretaries and chairmen. Classic formula.
Instead of watching new buildings go up, watching old buildings decay. And that's a very different feeling.
Right.
Now, you don't have to have new buildings going up all the time, but you need maintenance and a sense of excitement. And I agree with Bob. It just doesn't seem to be there right now.
Where do you think is the frontier of your fields? NASA seems to be the symbol simply for the shuttle at this point. What else is it doing?
Well, I can speak to that. We have gone through a very dark period. It's been 10 years now since there's been a launch of any vehicle to go out and explore other planets. And this is a decision that has nothing to do with Stony Brook. It's been an administrative problem, partly within NASA and partly within the successive administration. That's about to change. And next year, we hope we'll have two new launches. And we have a new project, which we've just been putting forward, which may get approved this year. And if so, we'll have a very vigorous program again.
Within NASA,
this new project involves cooperation with the Europeans. And there are studies going on now looking toward cooperation with the Soviet Union for a major Mars exploration, which if it happens toward the end of the 90s, would be comparable, I think, in its intellectual excitement to the lunar program at the end of the 60s. But it's not clear it's going to happen. It's pretty clear the Soviets are going to go to Mars. It's not at all clear that we're going to go
to Mars.
And bring samples back.
As a man, it'll be done
unmanned, but the big excitement is collecting Martian materials from identified geological areas and bringing them back to Earth for analysis. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very late to be doing that. I mean, we could have done it a long time ago.
Yes.
But at least it's going to be happening. But if the U.S. has to get going, if it wants to get on this boat, because the boat's leaving.
I see.
But there are signs that it might happen, that the U.S. would get involved. And the Soviets are encouraging it. In fact, they're almost flaunting it. They're saying, hey, guys, you want it or not?
I was just saying that's encouraging. I hope it comes up.
Yeah.
What was John Toll's role in the development of the department?
I used to have great fun with Johnny when I meet him in company, because we were classmates.
Were you?
Yeah, we both came in 65.
Yes.
And in fact, shortly before he got married, he was over dinner one night, and we were talking about the fact that we were in the vintage class of 65. John was very supportive. In those days, in those first few years, we had the impression, I know Albert had the impression, that the name of the game was spend the money before it goes away.
That's right.
He'd worked for the government for a long time. And it was there. I wouldn't say we were lavish. I think we were pretty clever about the way we spent it. But you didn't feel that there was a ceiling above you that you were constantly bumping your head on. And whatever you came up with, something plausible, John would listen. And he gave us pretty much what we wanted. We went up like a skyrocket in faculty. Alan Pond occasionally resisted us a little bit because we were continually wanting more and more and more. Part of his job description was to make sure we didn't outrun everybody else. But John was very, very supportive.
Yeah, I would support that too with a shorter time base. I would say, I remember two incidents, in fact. One, we were trying to recruit a rather distinguished senior person, and the gates had really closed on open season, open hunting for new faculty. And it wasn't at all obvious that this was going to be looked on favorably, but in fact, Toll got solidly behind it, and I believe he went personally up to Albany to arrange a professorship for this guy. Now, in fact, it fell through because Harvard made him a better offer. But the point is, Toll was really put himself on the line to do this at a time when it wasn't easy to do. I mean, he must have cashed in some chips to get this appointment.
They played to win, Carl. They really played to win. And the administration in recent years has seemed to play to lose. Part of it is because they generally are poor. Their resources are not there. But part of it is they're very poor in spirit. We have, for example,
lost the imaginative fire.
Almost reckless, I would say.
Yeah,
he was almost reckless.
Pardon?
Johnny was reckless.
He was reckless. He's still reckless.
But some of that is, you need some of that in order to deal with a bureaucracy that's this amorphous.
And it isn't, Johnny has been doing very well in Maryland. There are several people who are associated with the university. They think the world of him. It's characteristic of this place that by the time he left, a lot of the faculty felt it was time for him to leave.
Well, it might
and have been. And the last person they wanted to replace him was Emmerich. What they basically wanted was an administration they could push around, and they've had it. They've had it.
But maybe, you know, the pendulum will swing and start over again.
I don't know. I think it's very sad. We've reached the point now where we're no longer head and shoulders above the other centers. We are, in many areas, trying to reach them. They're growing. Their recruitment is booming, and ours is dwindling. Parenthetically, we have a new admissions office here, and from what I can see of her, I think she's going to turn the boat around, if the administration helps her. But she's been here for less than a year, and she's already got an arm-long list of things that she was told she would have and doesn't have.
That is a recurrent
theme. And that goes on all the time.
Yeah, that is a recurrent theme. That's another demoralizing aspect of life at Stony Brook in the last, 10, 15 years or so.
Yeah.
That these promises are made, and then they're not kept.
At the point of writing to Marburger and telling him that I reckon he's got 10 months to think of a better way of saving energy than turning off the air conditioning for 2 days each week during the summer. Because I have growth of mold and mildew, and I have problems with the computer arcing. And when I come in on Monday morning to teach a class during the summer, the conditions are unbearable. What the hell kind of economy is this?
Well, I mean, you can't work in your office.
No,
I have to work at home.
Well, of course, and that's one reason why a lot of people do work.
Yeah.
Which is centripetal and which is destructive.
Right.
My goodness, aren't we sure?
Yes, we're getting pretty discontented here. That's probably not.
I hope you weren't planning to write a story with a happy ending.
Right. Well, hey, it's
may
not
happen.
Over yet.
Yeah.
It's not over yet.
Okay, let's see. Are there any other questions? You've covered the water, I think.
With an oil slick.
What is this for, by the way? I don't understand. Did you get this
memorial
letter?
Volume or something?
There was an idea about, I guess, three years ago. This was Homer Neal's idea, I believe, that there should be a history of Stony Brook for the 25th anniversary. And they had asked two people, David Trask and John Pratt, to start collecting material and thinking about it. Well, Trask went to Washington, to the State Department, and he's just retired from that. And John says he has a little material, but I don't think they got very far. And then nothing was done until Neil came. And when I heard that there were plans, all I did was to offer Homer what help I could with regard to the 3 years that I've been in charge. And nothing else transpired until Jerry Schubel came, and he picked that up and called me in and asked if I would be interested to be helpful, and I said yes. And before he got back to me, I checked out William L. Sullivan's second wife. He had died. See whether there were any papers. He was chair of the council, local council. He succeeded Ward Melville as chairman of the council. And Ward came back from her in a nice little note that all of his papers had been thrown out at home, and nothing was available apparently through his secretary in the chambers. So all I did was pass that on to Jerry with a note saying, this is typical of what we will be up against if we
that are out in wait, the three governors that are really responsible for the university have all passed on, Dewey, Herman, and Rockefeller. The chairman of the board of trustees, the key years, Frank Moore, he's gone. Tom Hamilton, Jeff who appointed me, is gone, dead. Stan Ross is dead.
Is that right?
Yes. Stan went downhill for some reason or other, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I heard that.
And of course, Ward Melville and Bill Sullivan are gone. And so the idea was changed to forget the writing, but try to get some recollections on tape. You know, people who are important in the creation and development of the university. And that's what I've done so far, the starred people.
You've interviewed all these people?
Yes.
Oh my God, I've
been busy.
Well, I've interviewed Francis Bonner, and I'm working on existing faculty largely, but I have a call out to Boyer, who is president of the Carnegie Endowment for Advancement of Teaching, and is in Princeton. And to John Lee, the first president who is out at Palos Verdes, just south of Los Angeles. So that's as far as I will carry it, I think, because I have my own writing for it to do.
It's a monumental contribution, but I wonder if anybody's going to want to dig through it. I'm working on the collected papers and diaries and field notes of the geologists in anticipation of writing a biography. My God, that's only one guy. What a phenomenal job it is to sort through all this stuff, because he was born with a pencil in his hand and dropped it when he died. So.
But you know, this would be a nice project for a history student. They do this kind of stuff.
That's true.
And
for history, graduate student.
Yeah.